Good day and welcome to the podcast, To Be More. I'm your host, TJ Smith. To be more is exactly what we want. We want to be more than what some of the problems are that we all know exist in our metro area. So let's explore some of the topics that are of importance to you. And the reality is, crime is something that we constantly talk about here in Baltimore. We are poised to exceed the ominous number of 300 murders for the seventh straight year. While the politicians and those in academia discuss the need to treat gun violence as a disease and invest more in violence interrupter programs, the conversations and methodologies to stop the violence have happened for years, but now appears to be the first time that there has been a coordinated shift from one side to another, with social activism pushes to defund the police and fund more programs to target youth and influence behavior. Joining me today for the discussion is Dr. Johnny Rice II, who is an associate professor and chair at the Department of Criminal Justice at Coppin State University. Mr. Jason Johnson is the president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, and Ms. Angie Smith-Winder is a community advocate and Baltimore City Democratic State Central Committee member. Thank you all for joining us. But I want to start with you, Dr. Rice. You penned a recent article entitled "When Peacemakers Become Victims," and I'm going to get back to that specific topic, but I want to first focus on the crime and public health parallel. Citing the 2012 Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, past research has shown over the years a reduction of violence in Baltimore because of public health approaches being implemented to address violence. While we cannot fund ourselves out of the problem, it is also clear that a criminal justice response absent a community-centered public health approach will yield limited returns. In 2012, it appeared, at least from this research, that they believed some public health initiatives were working. So my two-part question for you is, what does treating violence, the crime, the guns, like a disease actually look like? And what do you believe happened that we didn't continue to build upon what appeared to be successful?
Well, first and foremost, I want to thank you, TJ, for having the opportunity to come and speak on such an important issue. I think when we look at a public health approach, we're really looking at prevention at different levels, trying to stop the issue of gun violence and other forms of violence from occurring in the first place, but we're also centered on really drilling down and looking at the underlying causes, be it mental health issues, poverty, lack of employment, criminal history that some residents have that may make it difficult for them to secure meaningful employment, delinquency as a result of fractured homes. And so that's just a snapshot of some of the issues that have been systemic in the city and continue to exist. I think that we have to continue to do our best to try to figure out why do we see some of these upticks in different areas as it relates to violent crime. And I think we can't do that without looking at a parallel between resources and services being provided. And so it's a complex issue, not just here in Baltimore, but if you go to New York City that had a period of dramatic crime decrease, even New York City that took a tough approach at different times still cannot actually tell you why crime went down and violent crime went down during that period. And there's researchers that will argue that it could be a myriad of reasons. I think here we need to continue to try to provide resources to communities, but also think that we have to address criminal enterprise, which has been consistent in Baltimore throughout the years.
And we're gonna stick a pin in that because I'm glad you brought up criminal enterprise, because that seems like a topic that some leadership wants to stay away from. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's an important part of this entire conversation of crime. How do we hold them accountable? And a great segue to Mr. Johnson, where policing has been under the microscope for the last several years. And in 2020, according to recently released FBI statistics, murder rose by 30%, the largest percentage increase since that data has been collected. Police will say it is because they don't have support. Activists are saying this proves police don't prevent crime, using this as evidence for their defund the police movement. Baltimore's sustained hike in murders has lasted for 7 years. From your position, what are you seeing as the primary factor for that spike in Baltimore, the 7 years? And how do you view addressing guns as a disease as policy?
Well, TJ, thank you, first of all, for the invitation to speak on this important topic. I do think it is clearly something that we need to talk more about and work on other solutions beyond the knee-jerk law enforcement solution. I know that may sound weird coming from me, because I tend to be the law enforcement advocate guy in these conversations. But to get to your question, I think that to address Dr. Rice's several points, I don't think anyone can argue that looking at root causes for violence or what causes people to become violent offenders, whether it's the home, the fractured home, I think, as Dr. Rice put it, education, lack of job opportunities, all of those things should be on the table. You know, addressing root causes, of course, is the way long term to address violent crime, whether it's in Baltimore or anywhere else. But I think it's very clear when you talk about the sustained increases in violence in Baltimore going back now about 7 years, that you go right back to 2015. What happened in 2015? It was a serious civil unrest, uprising, whatever you want to call it, after the death of Freddie Gray, which really caused many residents in Baltimore to question the legitimacy of the BPD, although those questions have been around for decades. It really came to a head in 2015. So much changed about policing, a Department of Justice investigation, the prosecution of several BPD officers related to the Freddie Gray case, and all measures of police productivity basically plummeted in 2015 and have remained low since then. Staffing at the BPD is at historic lows, from a high watermark in the early 2000s of about 3,300 officers. They're down about 1,000 fewer officers than that. The officers that are on the department, you could point to experience and training lapses, staffing issues in the homicide unit. We could go on and on and on. And it's very easy to support that. And what I'm saying here is that the reason why the numbers in homicides and non-fatal shootings went up in 2015 is because the police were disempowered. They may not have been defunded as they have in other cities, but certainly their staffing levels are at historic lows, and they are not approaching crime fighting as they did in the past. And when you look at other cities that now, as we sit here in 2021, have experienced this, you know, just a piece of this surge, nationwide surge in homicides that, like in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray, came after the death of George Floyd and all of the civil disorder, riots, whatever you want to call it, that existed throughout the country, and defunded in cities like Austin and Portland and Seattle, New York, that have seen these huge increases in crime, were also the cities that were actually where police were defunded. And so I think when you look at the first wave of violence increases in 2015 and 2016 in Baltimore and Chicago, primarily, those were the cities that saw controversial police involved incidents, pushback, riots, civil disorder. You saw that wave come earlier, and those numbers have remained high in those cities. And it wasn't until last year that we saw it in the other cities. So I think it's very clear the reason for the increase, and that is disempowerment, defunding of police.
So, Ms. Winder, you've had an opportunity to listen in on the conversation thus far, and from a community perspective. And, you know, I ask this question because sometimes I feel like there might be a bit of a disconnect. I don't know. I'm asking, do you feel the politicians and other decision makers are getting an accurate depiction of community thoughts on how to handle violence in the communities? And do you feel that the vast majority of members in your community understands what it means to treat gun violence as a disease? You know, does the community want both things from their government, like criminally going after violent people while investing in programs that disrupt the pattern early, but back to that first point about treating gun violence as a disease, when they hear that in the community, do they understand what that means after gunfire rings out and someone's on the ground dying or shot? Do they understand that?
Yeah, so thank you, CJ, again, for this opportunity. And I've been taking notes from both that were on. And just to answer your question from a community perspective, I believe that I really believe that the community kind of want both. You know, you want the police to be there to protect, but then there has been a disconnection. There has been a distrust in the community. I think it was Dr. Rice that mentioned about this criminal enterprise, this fractured homes, and let's go even further to say fractured communities. We've seen a lot of incidents, should I say, where the police have been very much a part of the issue, as well as our politicians. And so not to point a finger, but we have to say, you know, basically call a spade a spade. And so I think the biggest thing here is trust in the community. So yes, we may call 911 and want the police to come if there's an incident, but then we also have so many in the community that really just don't trust. And we know, you know, it's for me, I do believe that it is a whole public health approach that we should be taking. But I also know the importance of having the police involved in it and in this process altogether, should I say. But it's really hard when we don't have conversations. We don't have conversations in the community. We don't have our politicians and those in City Hall that are bringing the community to the table. I think I've kind of mentioned that even yesterday. They have so many programs or initiatives that they're having. But one thing I always say is that they're always missing the community when they speak. That's the same as if we're in school, you know, and we're trying to do something for our students. You can't advocate for our students and leave them out of the table, you know, leave them out of the thought of what can we do. So for me, again, I think the biggest thing is the distrust. And I know I hear the defund, you know, police. I know that that's kind of what the advocates are going for and this whole national level. But I do want to say in Baltimore City that even though funding may still be a low, perhaps, I think one had mentioned, and although that is the advocacy for defunding the police, I will say that, you know, the mayor here in Baltimore City actually added to the budget for Baltimore City Police. And even with that, we're still getting the numbers, the 300 plus. We're still getting a short, you know, a short staffing of police. We're still getting, you know, we're being more reactive than proactive. So I guess for me, I love to hear what are we missing, because the money is there, you know, the crime is up higher. We have a new commissioner. Maybe that's an issue, you know, the stability. We don't have that stability to have anyone that's in that position to gain that trust, to have that relationship. So I'll end there for that moment. But I would say that that's definitely one of the biggest issues is maybe the community really doesn't understand that, and a conversation such as this, you know, such as what you're having now is very important for the community.
So it sounds to me, Ms. Winder, that there's a disconnect. There are things happening. There are programs. There are worthwhile things possibly happening, but the right people aren't engaged at the beginning. So sometimes they might not make it to the community. And that's something that I've heard often. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes, most definitely. As I stated, they just had it was just a meeting. I can't remember the name, but with the mayor, and I get it, the state's attorney's office and the police department. But I guess with me, I'm still looking at where, and I'm very much connected with the community and know other community leaders. And, you know, most of them are like, we weren't even invited. We didn't know about it. We weren't there at the table. One thing I can say, you know, not to, you know, boast about one administrator over another, but one thing I appreciated from the past administration, and I hope that this one picks it up as well, is that they had these call to action meetings with stakeholders, with those that were in the community. And we cannot, and not to say that's the case, but we cannot put anything past, you know, politics over people, no, you know, titles over it, just mainly everyone should be represented somehow, some way. In my role as the president of NECO, one of the things I try to do is to reach out to every stakeholder in the communities under NECO. No matter what, no matter what our differences are, we can learn from one another. And I get, again, that is very important when you have a disconnection. And yes, there are, you know, ROCA, there's State Safe Street, there are programs out here. But it's unfortunate because even with all that's going on, there are still community members that don't realize or understand that these programs exist. So I think that's very important.
So Ms. Winder touched on a couple of things. And as a point of reference, Mayor Scott did increase the police budget in fiscal year 2022. And part of it is is compelled to because of the consent decree. But in reality, the vast majority of the police budget is salary. And the police budget is very high, over $550 million, I believe $558 million, the largest expenditure from the Baltimore City government. Now, the school budget is the highest budget in the city, where the vast majority of their funding comes from the state. And another interesting point from Ms. Winder was the language that she used. She said new police commissioner, and that could be part of the problem. And I'll get to Dr. Rice and Mr. Johnson again on that. She said new police commissioner, and I believe he is about to go into his third year. And when you say new police commissioner, that's because the turnover has been so much. We continue to look at the person as new because it seems like it's always someone new. Dr. Rice, the instability at the top, whether it's the mayor, whether it's the police commissioner, how does that affect the people on the ground, from the officers, from the citizens? What are you seeing in that regard?
Well, I think I have a couple thoughts. I think first and foremost, stability and leadership ties into what Ms. Winder said in terms of trust, be it on the political level, on the governmental level from our public servants. When there is consistency and expectations are met, I think trust is cultivated. In the city of Baltimore, and I was born and raised in Baltimore, as it was then, as it is now, everything is really relational. And so if trust isn't established with on the political side, on the community side, with city council persons and others, it can make it very, very difficult for an individual to feel like they can share intelligence or information involving a crime, particularly a homicide, with law enforcement if there's distrust there. And if there's a sense of apathy based on leadership, the next could be the expectation that why should I report it anyway? Because it's not going to make a difference. And so what we find is that we have pockets of dark figures of crime where for different reasons, be it a stop snitching culture, be it for different reasons such as language barriers or someone is here and concerned about their immigration status, those things can determine how a person may respond. And so I think when leadership is community-centered, community-focused, continues to have the conversations with the residents of that community, those residents who may come from all walks of life, not just the citizen that's been in the community and is the homeowner, but also a comfortability speaking to juveniles who may be squeegee kids, or speaking to individuals who they may have their eye on in terms of suspects and crimes and saying to them, hey, we are aware of who you are, what you're doing, and we're going to try our best to ensure that you don't continue to wreak havoc in this community. And so I think it's a dual approach. I think that indeed it's important that we have leadership that's visible, leadership that connects with the community and all residents in that community, but it's also a balance between accountability as well as engagement. And so trust is important, but gang leaders may not be concerned about trust. They may not be looking for a pathway to change. And so for those individuals, there has to be policing that is zero tolerance. And I don't mean zero tolerance in terms of the old school community, the whole community. But what I mean is that individuals who are clearly not going to make that change are not interested in employment and advancement opportunities through these various organizations such as ROCO, the Center for Urban Families, then it has to be a tough discussion as to with the community as well as with law enforcement, what is going to be the collective decision and work that everyone can agree on that needs to happen in order to make our community safe. Because a victim of crime, if they lose someone, they're not concerned about this or that or politics, or they are angry that they lost a loved one. And so I think that it's important that we establish trust, but also understand that people have been in Baltimore a long time and some have not seen change. And that sense of apathy is going to be hard to turn around. It can happen, but it's going to take a lot of work, not just on law enforcement side, but on the community-based side in a collaborative way.
I think that's it. People want accountability. And sadly, some, until you're a victim, it's a difference. And I think that comes back to the conversation of, is there a disconnect? And oftentimes, while I'm in the community, I hear people saying, why don't they just do? And I don't know if they understand the separation of powers, you know, some basic civics of how government works. And you're basically talking about some of the targeted policing, which, you know, I think we can all agree some more oversight needed to be had with Baltimore police. And that's why the consent decree exists. At what point do we get to a place where we believe the oversight is there to allow a little bit more of that policing? And if it is existing, does it need to be talked about? And with that, I'll transition to you again, Mr. Johnson, and ask you, and I'll put you on a spot with this question, because I want to get back to the transition and leadership, because we've seen a lot of it. And that transition where it's been talked about, where you can have police officers that do 25 years or 30 years, they can wait out a commissioner and not change their ways. Should there be some change in the policy or the legislature where a commissioner gets a term that overlaps the mayoral term and they get confirmed by the city council, maybe their firing should have to get nominated to the city council, where a supermajority of the city council has to agree that they should be terminated? Is that something that you could get on board with? Does that make sense? Just as a question, to try to take the politics out of such a political job that seems to change with every mayoral administration or every controversy.
Yeah, TJ, I think that's exactly it. I know we're talking about a very narrow slice of the overall problem here, that being the tenure of the BPD commissioner and the terms under which he or she may be removed. But it really is a much bigger deal. I think for those who've seen the inside of the BPD or have had plenty of experience interacting with those in leadership of the BPD, really understand exactly the point you're hitting on, TJ, and that is that in order to change an organization, whether it's law enforcement organization or any other, they're like a big ship. And if you're at the helm and you're trying to turn that ship, it's going to take a little bit of time. You're going to need a little team to help you out to do it. And you need everyone on the ship helping you get everything turned around. And if the bulk of the line officers on the BPD, and certainly, you know, the union and the organizations represent the employees of the BPD, know that the captain of the ship, their days could be numbered. And in fact, the crew of the ship can play a hand in worsening the situation for the captain and making their tenure even shorter. And I think that's, you know, we've kind of seen that over the decades, that when the inside of the BPD gets kind of tired of whoever the commissioner is and wants them to move on for one reason or another, they have the ability to make them look bad. And so there does need to be some insulation from the politics, because if you want to reach a strategic objective, which is, you know, achieving crime reduction, achieving compliance with the consent decree, achieving, you know, meaningful organizational change, you know, you do need some stability at the top. And that's something that BPD has not seen for some time. And it's because of exactly what you said, TJ, and that is politics. And the politics of the city colors the politics of the BPD and every other city agency. And I think it's pretty well established that the political culture in the city is not healthy. And so it does, you know, really does impact the agencies of the city.
So this is going to be a tough question. This is for all. This is probably the toughest question that can be asked, that has been asked over and over again. And it's very simple. Is there anything that you all believe we can do as a city right now to have an immediate impact on violent crime and reduce the number of people being shot and killed on our streets? And that question has to be asked because we saw really an immediate spike in 2015. The rest of the nation has seen an immediate spike in 2020. Are there immediate things that can be done, or is this something that we're going to have to deal with long term? I think we have to ask that question because we are hearing a lot of what the long-term needs are, but are there any short-term instant gratification needs that can slow the pace of this violence? And I'm going to start with you, Ms. Winder. What do you think, if you could suggest to the mayor, to the police commissioner, to the state's attorney, to other interested parties, if you did this right now, you absolutely could have an impact on violence in this city. Is there anything?
Ooh, that is it's a hard one. So I want to acknowledge that there are some things in the works. So hopefully this next General Assembly, things will even pass, you know, further. There are some reforms that need to be had. There are some city charter amendments that our city councilmen and women can actually push forward that they're not. And there's a host of these things. I mean, there are laws in place that are ancient. And if they, you know, went into them and actually did some city charter amendments, I mean, I think most were even advocating to amend some of these charter, city charters, but nothing was done when they got in. And this is not, again, to point fingers, but there are some immediate actions that can be taken. Also, you know, I believe in that word, that term of criminal enterprise in politics. I don't know if anyone read Not in My Neighborhood, but it breaks down so much of just Baltimore politics, how dirty it can be. And we have to acknowledge, you know, as much as someone may point a finger to the police department, politics is nothing in general of this, you know, last few years. This is like a history. The racial, you know, divide, the racism, there are so many things that we can do. So when you ask immediate, I would say we have those who are in office who can actually make immediate changes and they choose not to. And I would just encourage them to, you know, when you have these town halls, I mean, I think Councilman Robert Stokes had a town hall or a meeting, should I say, with Dr. Santelices. There are things without education that could be done. And all we do sometimes is we just have these town halls. We go away until the next quarter when there's another meeting, but nothing immediate. And I'm really asking, when we have these town halls or even during this podcast, anyone who's listening, take heed to what's happening. Nothing is new that we're talking about. It's just that nothing has really been pushed to, you know, move forward with it. These appointments, you know, with our mayor, and not just the current mayor, but our mayor can appoint our commissioner. And I do believe that should be changed, just the same as our school board. That is appointments by the mayor. And if there's an issue there, I think that's an issue in itself of appointments. So I really think that, You know, and then there's another one with the Office of the Inspector General. We have someone there that's oversighting, you know, some of these issues. And now we're trying to change because maybe she has too much power. But to me, she's opening things. She's looking at, you know, things that can be hashed or things that can be changed. But we have to be open to the changes that we're asking. We want change. And then when it happens, we're like, wait, it's too much. But, you know, these are the things I think can be immediate. Those that are in office right now can change, you know, like I said, the city charter, some reforms with our state legislators. I don't know. I don't want to shout her out, but I will. And you can add it if you want. But I do want to shout out Senator Jill Carter. She's doing something, some amazing things with trying to do, you know, reforms. And these are things that we've asked for. And yet, you know, it still hasn't been something we are used to. So, of course, it's not going to feel good. But we have to recognize that there are some issues that we need to kind of hash out. And we need to make sure that we look at the things that are has been very negative in our community. And no matter how it looks, we have to see those changes if we really want to see a real change in our city. So I hope I answer some. But again, it's the stability at the top that's been heard all over. And it's that, you know, and again, it's not so much just pointing just to the politician, because to be honest, I'm encouraging our communities to get more involved, like civic engagement. And then one last thing, I'm sorry, I'm a community person. I love what some movements and organizations are doing, such as the We Out Us. They're out there, they're going into the community. That's something that we can do immediately. They're going out, they're getting people jobs, they're getting people, you know, if they need resources to substance abuse. So programs such as this is what we need to invest in. This is what we can do to actually make a sustainable change. So programs such as that, invest in them and get involved in them.
Yes, and I'll push just a little bit because I want to know a little bit more about, because I want to try to nail down to the immediate. And when you talk about some of the laws, the General Assembly, the City Council, the City Charter, what types of things? So people can maybe understand if they need to be more vocal advocates for something. Are there any specific bills that people might need to rally around that could have an impact on the safety of their neighborhood more immediately that they should be advocating for?
So I know with the police reform, there has been some changes there that's already going to be passed. Mm-hmm. As far as like city council, yeah, there's like 200 something pages there. But if I had to really choose, so there's some things even down to housing. I mean, and when we talk about crime, we talk about the environment. You know, we talk about blight. There are things that we can actually help right now in the charter. I mean, I would have to like pull it up to see it specifically what's out there. But I do know that there are some advocates right now. I believe Councilwoman Odette Ramos, where she's reaching out when it comes to the housing part. These are the things that can help, you know, and even with the mental health that's in there. So if I can, I'll probably like kind of look through it and see specifics, but there's a multitude. And I know it's really hard because, you know, they have their meetings and it's really hard to, you know, be involved. But I can say one thing out of this pandemic, it has allowed us to stay virtual or at least as a hybrid. And everybody can make a, you know, some time where they can listen in to what's going on.
You're exactly right. And one of the other things I know that you've talked about.
But that might be my immediate, like, get involved there. Like,
right.
There's so many.
And, you know, you mentioned mental health. And one of the things in the mayor's crime plan that, you know, I commended him on that I think is great. And one of the places that I used to work at had a plan just like this, where it's diverting 911 calls to mm-hmm. mental health advocacy groups that handle that stuff. So a police officer doesn't respond to that and you can divert it to the right person or the right group to handle. And I think that's important to limit those interactions from escalating potentially into something else. And a big shout out to We Are Us. They're doing some amazing work out in the community, getting some people the resources they need. And it is a bit of an irony with a inspector general that is doing some good work in a city that has had two mayors have to step down and face criminal charges, along with two police commissioners that also faced criminal charges in the past 20 years, and a host of other politicians, and of course the other criminal acts with people entrusted with that power, that's been a focal point of having too much power. So a bit of an irony in that.
I was gonna say it's like a half and half, but what I can say is we might not agree with everything, but this is what we ask for as citizens, right?
And arguably it's mm-hmm. what's needed at a time like this. Yes. Argue with the consent decree all you want, but are a different set of standards needed to reset the clock so that the trust can be rebuilt. And with that, Dr. Rice, I want to pivot to you and ask you that same, kind of loaded question that is very difficult. Is there anything the city can do right now to impact violent crime and reduce the number of people being shot and killed on our streets, the number of mothers and fathers burying their children?
Well, one of the things that I want to speak to is clearly, and public health speaks to this, but being able to effectively communicate and reach people and get them resources and information that can affect change. And so part of our discussion was this disconnect in terms of residents not getting maybe the information regarding the resources or opportunities or services that they may need. And so I think we all can take ownership and make a commitment to do better to make sure that all residents in a community understands what's available to them. As a criminal justice expert and a former practitioner, someone who's worked in the foster care system in Baltimore, worked with at-risk youth in Baltimore, worked in the prison system, I've seen the lifespan of young people who come from fractured homes and then become the delinquent teenager and then end up in a correctional facility due to poor decisions and other societal influences. And again, it's not making excuses, but it's looking at the reality, which narrows a window of opportunity, can create strain, that can also move some residents to making bad decisions. My philosophy, someone who trains scholars, they go into law enforcement, the courts, corrections, as well as other social justice and community-based organizations, is to prepare them the best way that we can in highlighting the reality, sharing information regarding theory, and also working with them to be non-biased and non-judgmental so that they can really have an open mind, an open lens as they become future officers who may go through the academy and then are in the community. What I will say that I would love to see is the aspect of consideration and advancing of innovation and looking at unique ways that we can attack a problem that continues to exist in terms of high crime. So what do I mean? So I remember looking at a strategy in Detroit where they had a lack of testing for rape kits that had been sitting. And the prosecutor, I believe, was district attorney, she partnered with UPS to develop a tracking system so they were able to not only identify the kits, but their progression from A to Z in terms of the process, bringing justice to those victims of sexual assault. When I was at the Vera Institute, we had what was called spinoffs. So we would help communities develop an organization, be it a nonprofit entity, help to grow the capacity of that organization. And then once that organization had sea legs under it, it would then spin off and become its own entity. So Common Justice was a restorative justice program that worked within the community and working to be a supplement to law enforcement in a meaningful way. And I think the last point I'll make is that demonstration projects that involve the community, testing of ideas, growing of organizations, and evaluation of organizations to determine effectiveness, I think are indeed important. If we say that there's nothing new under the sun, and if we continue to see homicide rates that are exceedingly high since I've been a teenager in Baltimore City, and now I'm an adult, then that means that the same way we transform business, the same way we transform education, we need to transform safety and figure out ways to be innovative to address some of the crime that we see in our community to this point.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's program evaluation, a matrix of how we're doing is super important. We can no longer continue to do things because we've always done them that way and get the same results. And so many continue to grow up with this trauma in Baltimore. And it's something, thankfully, that we're talking a lot more about today, because we know hurt people hurt people. And finally, we're addressing that as an underlying issue with the continued violence. And Mr. Johnson, I have to give you a crack at this question. You know, it's a difficult one, but we have to ask it because that's the question every time an alert goes out about a shooting in a neighborhood. What can be done right now? They're laying it at the feet of whoever is the elected politician at the moment, whoever the police commissioner is at the moment. So is there anything, or is this our new normal until all of these investments that have been talked about for this last several minutes are come to fruition? What can be done right now, and if anything?
So I'm going to answer this fully recognizing that what I'm about to say is not the entire solution. This is a stopgap way of addressing what has been a multi-year spiking. It's hard to even call it a spike anymore because for the last several years, it has been the new normal. But I think there is a way to start reducing that as the effectiveness of a lot of these other programs that have been discussed have lots of promise to be effective. And, you know, certainly they are part of the strategy. But the most immediate thing for me, the very first thing that came to my mind is to create transparencies around criminal justice outcomes. And right now there are not. So, you know, we don't know how the system is. Well, we presume it's performing poorly just because we're looking at the homicide rate. But we don't know behind the scenes what happens. Largely, we don't know what happens when serious cases, I'm talking about homicides and non-fatal shootings and robberies, go to court. We don't know. Largely, we don't know what happens. You can research an individual case and largely, you know, kind of figure out what happened, but you don't know system-wide what has happened. You have allegations being made that the state's attorney is ineffective. She defends those allegations by saying we have a 98% conviction rate, but you don't know what's behind that. How many cases were dropped in order to get that 98% conviction rate? And of those cases where there was a conviction, how many, in terms of percentage, what percentage of those cases resulted in, you know, probation or some, ineffective sentence at the end of the day? We don't know what happened. And just having transparency alone, there's been a couple of comments about the inspector general bringing light to some of the things that no one really knew about before she took her office and began digging. That's what we need. We need built-in transparency around the criminal justice system to know exactly how it's performing and be able to compare it with how it performed 8 years ago and 15 years ago and 20 years ago, because we just don't know the answer. The second part of my response is I actually really like the plan the mayor has rolled out on group violence reduction. I think it has a lot of promise. It has worked in other cities. It can be effective. It's not the whole solution, but it is a solution. The problem is, and I'll flag this as a problem with hopes that we can overcome it, is that it requires strong leadership. And it requires some unanimous support across three, in Baltimore, it would be really three individual folks. And that's the mayor, the state's attorney, and the police commissioner. And if those three individuals will stay in lockstep, will subordinate their egos and their own political interests and put at the top of the list of things that are important, reducing crime by following this strategy, I think it can be effective. Unfortunately, I think that is going to be the problem. And I think even in the days around the announcement by the mayor and the police commissioner and the state's attorney, who stood together and announced this and pledged cooperation and pledged that they would work in lockstep, within days of that, one of those people was out bashing the others publicly in a community setting. And so that's not encouraging that there can be ongoing cooperation, collaboration, and ego subordination and subordination of political interests in furtherance of the goal, which should be everyone's shared goal of reducing violent crime.
Well, I'm going to try to wrap that up, those comments for this particular question, in an optimistic way and say the group violence reduction is something we're going to have to give a little bit of time, but say that is optimistic looking forward because it can, in fact, work. And with what Ms. Winder and what Dr. Rice said, it puts us on a trajectory in the right direction. And it's important that we have the right stakeholders at the table and that the community understands it. And we're able to treat the people who we need to treat. And as long as we continue to do this in a very consistent way, we have the opportunity to make some immediate impact. And that's what is critical here, because we're burying way too many young people. We've seen more young people shot and killed this year, and it's unfair. It continues, and it's heartbreaking every time. Hopefully, Baltimore can be a leader in these reductions, and we all should be cheerleaders for whoever sits in the mayor's seat, the police commissioner's seat, the state's attorney seat, regardless of our personal opinions, because their success is our success. We're wrapping it up. I want to say thank you again to everyone.
Well, no, TJ, I just want to say I appreciate you coordinating this discussion. And to Ms. Winder and Mr. Johnson, it's a pleasure to get to connect with you all as well. And TJ, I'll definitely follow up with you, sir.
Indeed.
Yes, I was just going to say thank you as well. This is actually what's needed going forward as well. And this would be a good way to educate those that are in the community to know what's going on as well.
And just to let you guys know as well, this particular podcast is not going to solely be crime related. The second one will probably, I'm going to do my best to make it the polar opposite of crime, just so it doesn't become typecast. I don't want it to be that way, but we have to get back to it because it's just such a big issue in Baltimore. But want to talk about a bunch of different things related to Baltimore. So I will be circling back with you guys again, because we have to talk about violence interrupters and some other things related to this topic that we only scratched the surface on. So thank you all again and have a wonderful day. And if you're Ravens fans, it should be a fantastic week.
Go Ravens.
Go Ravens. I am.
Thanks, TJ. It was a privilege.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, guys. And thanks to all of you as we aim to be more. Until next time, take care.